This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 Coco. I am Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego. I'm joined, as always, by Andrew Keats, assistant editor. Hello, Andy.
Scott, good to be here.
And Sarah Libby, managing editor. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
This week, guys, it happened. My kids and a bunch of other kids went back to classrooms, a collection of classrooms known as school. It's amazing, though, how different some of the experiences are. High schools do not sound fun at all right now. I hope that changes for the high schoolers. Speaking of schools, local schools are getting more than $2 billion on top of their annual funding. Our Ashley McGlone has been trying to track down where all that money is going, and we have some details to report out. And San Diego Mayor Todd Gloria has proposed major changes for policing in the city. We'll explain what he's pushing. Finally, the San Diego Convention Center has gone through a lot since the start of the pandemic. Haven't we all, Convention Center? We hear you. We feel you.
Hashtag relatable.
We'll explain how it has managed, though, to stay afloat financially by completely reinventing itself. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Before we get to the news, we want to take a minute to thank you all. A lot of podcast listeners gave during our fundraising campaign the last few weeks. You made a big difference, and we appreciate the support. So a shout out to Chasen Peters, Mark Clark, Scott Sody, Laura Ann Fernia, SLK. Thank you so much. I'll mention the podcast when they donated last week. Thank you so much. And if you want to get your gift in and tell us what you like about the show, you can do that anytime. Just go to voiceofsandiego.org/donate. That's VOSD.org/donate. So guys, the great reopening is happening. It really is. The Padres, the amusement parks. I did get some pushback I wanted to highlight. We talked about this last week, but an immunologist named Christian G. Anderson is out there. He's pooping on the party. He's not into this whole thing. Christian G. Anderson, immunologist at Scripps Research Institution, said he feels like the governor and the local public health authorities are misguided in what they're doing. He said that basically, you know how we liberalized a lot of these things, like access to things over the last couple of weeks, even though our rate went up of COVID cases. And he said, obviously, our point and the governor's point and others was that we're only concerned now about hospitalizations. We've protected people who are vulnerable to going to the hospital with COVID, and that's the only thing we should really be focused on right now. And his point was, look, if you let that happen, you are letting the virus get a lot of opportunities to mutate. So if you don't care about cases anymore, you're allowing them to like kind of mutate and become something that we can't control with vaccines. He said he thinks schools should be open, but fewer the other things should be open at this time. So there's always going to be, I guess, that kind of voice. And it's kind of notable that the local public health officials and the governor have disregarded it for now. They're going. This opening is happening. They're talking about events. They're talking about parties. They're talking about conventions coming back, everything.
I mean, it does at a certain point become a policy decision. Right? Like you have multiple different areas of expertise contributing to pieces of advice to policymakers who then have to make a decision, which at least theoretically is their area of expertise. And so you have to weigh the value of reopening the economy against the value of creating this continued breeding ground for potential mutations. I don't know exactly how you weigh those things, but at a certain point saying, defer to the experts, you do have to choose an expert to defer to at some point, because there's going to be different people from different areas of expertise and different people even within areas of expertise who are going to disagree.
It's kind of like the president, right? He has to weigh the concerns of generals who are always going to recommend a certain form of action in dealing with a situation, and they just have to weigh all that. But also, this governor clearly wants to get to the other side of this situation. There's no doubt about that.
There's
right?
a clear political reality in place that would make you at least a little bit apprehensive about whether this is a decision entirely being driven by conflicting areas of expertise, essentially.
Well, San Diego Unified, Chula Vista schools, other districts reopened in some form April 12th. My kids going back 4 days a week. They're there now. My wife got an email, the first ever email from our daughter who was in another place ever, which was fascinating. And it's, I think something interesting happened with the pandemic that like kids got really good at computer stuff, like different, they were already pretty good at iPads and things like that, but they also now know how to communicate online. And, I think that for elementaries, it's gone pretty well. I'm not so sure about the high school situation right now. Sounds pretty miserable. Like you're basically a couple you're in the high school for like a day or two. You can only stay in your room online, usually with people. Doesn't feel like it's the kind of high school that people are into.
I also hadn't necessarily realized that some of the incentive money was structured in a way that even if you only open one grade, you're allowed to get at least some of it, I believe. And so some districts, only seniors are allowed back. And I had sort of thought it was much broader than that, but there's only one grade of students going back to school.
Yeah, so Ashton McGlone dug into that. More than $2 billion is coming into the San Diego region's 42 public K-12 school districts. It was the largest state in relief, federal relief packages we have seen, I guess I can ever imagine. Schools were granted wide latitude over how to spend the money. New state law providing reopening incentive money explicitly allows the funds to be spent on salaries for classified employees or certificated employees, those are union, non-union, such, in-person instruction or services. So, Sarah, break down a little bit of what Ashley found in there. Basically, some schools just said thanks to their teachers, handed out some extra money, and there were some other situations like that.
Yeah, so we had already known a little bit about school districts giving some money to teachers and other employees with these COVID funds, but it turns out it's pretty widespread and it's being done in different ways. Like you said, some of it is just sort of thank you money or stipends for things required by working at home, equipment and utilities, things like that. Working on the different things that working at home requires, like keeping track of student participation, one district said was extra work that they were paying teachers for on top of their salaries. Some were just straight up labeling it as appreciation, and then others are doing more hazard pay for going back in person.
Yeah, so this isn't, as far as we can tell, the bulk of the money going out, right? This is just an interesting part of it.
Yeah, I think it represents a relatively small percentage. It's just the same sort of interesting dynamic in which these people are teachers and they've been teaching the same, well, not the same way they were before the pandemic, but they're fundamentally teachers who are teaching and they're getting money from these COVID funds, in some cases even before schools were open, for doing teaching type activities.
I can't recall if we've had this conversation on mic or off mic. I have the misfortune of talking to you all so often and almost always through a Zoom screen. And so it sometimes becomes really hard to remember. But basically, the idea of hazard pay is a little bit of a curveball because so much of the conversation around reopening was about waiting until it was safe. And if you wait until it's safe, then there is no hazard. And if there is a need for hazard pay, then it suggests that the decision is not entirely about whether or not it's safe, that you could actually be coaxed back for money. And so that is a confounding variable in the conversation about reopening schools and what sort of expectations there should be for teachers to even introduce it into the equation.
Particularly if you're being offered hazard pay and the only students who are back are in the class of adults who are eligible to receive the vaccine, which means that, you know, potentially teachers won't just be vaccinated, but also their students. And so it's just interesting that those would be the people receiving hazard pay. Certainly, like, a person in a grocery store can't guarantee that all of their customers are over 17 years old and therefore might have a higher likelihood of having been vaccinated.
So one of the biggest school district in the region, obviously San Diego Unified, we don't have anything about them doing anything like this, correct?
Not as far as hazard pay, no.
Yeah. One of the things we've been tracking a lot is the question of what happens in the fall now as they've gotten the schools open in some form in the spring. And this feels like as best they can do before the end of the year. And the question then is what happens in the fall? And one thing I didn't quite realize is how present the state law that requires in-person school actually may play in this. So that law was waived last year, but it is in effect for next year unless it is waived again. And so some of the things we've heard back from school districts, we're doing a survey on for our Parents Guide to Public Schools like we've been doing over the last few years. And a lot of people were getting responses back from school districts around the county that are like, well, we have to go back full time in person next year unless they change the law. And so I think there will be a lot of really interesting discussions on the state level in the next few weeks about whether they will allow districts to do any kind of hybrid programs like they're doing right now, or whether it'll be you go back in person or you can have an online option.
Well, and I wonder how what you mentioned about the sort of conditions around high school right now in a lot of places and how many people will continue to want to attend in those circumstances, and then how much that information will be used in as some sort of feedback into what happens in the fall.
Yeah, I think that's what was kind of bothering me there. I heard from a few people that were like, well, this proves a lot of people didn't want to go back. No, it proves that they didn't want to go back to like one or two days where they're stuck in a room, kind of like that. I keep likening it to detention. Like if you're in a high school and you can only be in one room for a day, you can't go out and hang out with people, you can't walk around, there's no community, that doesn't feel like high school. So I can imagine being in high school and be like, well, I might as well just roll out of bed and just log on like I have been doing. The UT gathered some really interesting first-person takes from students across the region. I thought those were interesting. There was one kid really hammered San Diego Unified for its online offerings as a high school student. We witnessed a little bit of that ourselves this year. It's just a fascinating situation. But I don't know how much changes. One thing that seemed really clear, though, all school districts are going to be offering in some form some kind of online option full-time, not as a sub for in-person, but as just like a parallel system, and then independent study options. So we're going to try to gather all that information together about exactly what each district's doing. It's a pretty interesting development, though, that, you know, could fundamentally change what a lot of kids do forever.
Yeah, imagine if it had just been proposed as like a new policy 18 months ago. It would have been, I'm sure I've made a similar comparison to that on some other topics. Like, for instance, the restaurant patios is something I keep making that point about. Is like, if the city of San Diego had, instead of just allowing these because of a pandemic, had just said, we want to turn parking spaces into places for people to enjoy themselves. We're going to do a pilot program. We're going to waive all permitting fees for a year and encourage restaurants to build these little patios in the park, in street parking. and they and as many people did it as had done it, they would be like, this is the biggest success in municipal government history. We've never done something quite so successful. Look at this, you know.
Do we even know what they're going to do with that yet, by the way?
Great question. No, I don't think so. I don't think they know what they're going to do with it yet.
And I mean, in both cases, they would represent like such a turning on its head of existing like priorities, yeah, like, because restaurants are always the first to want to protect potential parking for their customers, in the same way that schools are always, you know, wary of online options for school offered by charters. And so now the fact that they're, you know, have been forced to embrace these options is really interesting.
One of the things that just happened right before we started recording this podcast is we got the mayor's of the city of San Diego, Mayor Todd Gloria's proposed budget for the 2022 fiscal year. And in that budget, the mayor proposes actually cutting $4 million of overtime for police in that budget. We're going to have to understand exactly what he means. Obviously, I bet police officers aren't going to be that excited about that. Probably not. They want to use that money to redirect it to some of the other priorities they have about police. But it comes on the heels of a big package of reforms, Sarah, that he has offered. A lot of the focus in recent days has been on Gloria's recommendation that the city eliminate existing gang injunctions, explore alternatives to arresting low-level offenders, put limits on pretext stops. But there's much more. Sarah, give us a rundown of what has been proposed.
Yeah, so you ran through some of the big ones. Others are sort of less controversial, things like strengthening the types of training the officers go through, which has, you know, been proposed pretty consistently over the last 3 years. Reviewing hiring practices, which is something that's being explored at the state level as well. And then kind of reconsidering which types of offenses or calls are directed to the police department. And so it's kind of interesting. You mentioned that Gloria just proposed cutting overtime. And when you combine that with the fact that his policing plan suggests, you know, maybe not all calls or certain types of offenses should go to the police, he pretty prominently said he didn't support defunding the police. But when you put cutting overtime together with directing certain calls to other types of people, that those are both kind of chipping away at what the defund the police crowd is aiming to get at.
Yeah, and I think we sort of went round and around this conversation last summer, where this was a reasonably common response that you would have people say, oh, I don't support defunding the police, but I do support reprioritizing who handles certain functions that are currently handled by police. And if you ask people what defund the police meant, they might say, well, we don't actually want to have no police, but we want to reprioritize, you know, whatever. So people who ostensibly disagreed would end up saying very similar things sometimes. And I think Todd Gloria was an example of somebody who said that although he said, I do not support defunding the police, I do support doing these other things. So this is consistent with that. And I guess what the question would be is, long term, what are the budget effects of that? You know, as you implement these changes, not just in overtime spending, which has a pretty obvious budget effect, but the changing who handles certain types of calls within a year, can you say, oh, well, now we know the effects of this and we can move some money around again? You know, does this set you up for further budget changes in the future, basically?
Yeah, so when in his announcement about the budget, he said he wants to cut that $4 million from police overtime and use it to fund the creation of the new Commission on Police Practices that they're creating to oversee and investigate police misconduct investigations and reports and complaints. So, Sarah, one of the other things that our Jesse Marks looked into was this question of the Homeland Security Department. What does it do, and why does he want it out of the police department?
Yeah, this was a change that we noticed that I think didn't get as much attention as some of the higher profile pieces of the plan, like gang injunctions. But it only recently moved under the SDPD umbrella. This is a city office, not the federal Office of Homeland Security. It's a different office that is also called the Office of Homeland Security, really helpfully. And it mostly deals with terrorism and emergency threats, disasters and things like that. And it gets a lot of funding from federal sources, outside sources. And so directing it under the police department meant that police had some say under how all of that money was controlled. And so, like I said, it's only been, I think, 2 years that it's been under the department, and Gloria is saying, you know, that change was a mistake and it's time to make it back under civilian control. So one other sort of just general takeaway I had from Gloria's plan is that, you know, obviously this is in the early stages, and so it makes sense to me that there's a lot of really tentative language. But I do want to point out that, like, a lot of these plans are to explore the possibility of making a change or to review whether this is the best way to do something. And so it's certainly possible to carry out this plan and do nothing, to review the hiring practices and decide that they're just fine, or to explore making changes and decide that you don't want to make changes. And so I think the details are going to matter a lot when it comes to each of these individual components.
One of the things you wrote about last week was this two or so measures in the state legislature that may add pre-qualifications to officers before they are allowed to be hired. And one of them was pretty big, said they had to get actually a college degree or something else. Explain what is the theory and proposal there?
Yeah, so Gloria's plan also talks about reviewing hiring practices, like I said, but there are two sort of competing bills in the legislature. One was developed by police unions, and that's clearly their preferred version. And that one would merely just incentivize more education and more training for existing officers. So if you don't have a degree, but you want to work on your degree, maybe it would help you get scholarships or be part of programs that would help you further that push. And then the other far more controversial bill would require that all new officers either be 25 years old or have a college degree. And so the thinking with that one is there's a pretty good amount of research showing that police use of force, you're far more likely to deploy force if you are young or if you are uneducated. And so the thinking, I think, is sort of that you're kind of elevating the class of recruits so that you have people who are more mature and more in control of their impulses. And it turns out a lot of departments certainly don't require degrees or even track whether their officers have degrees, which I thought was really interesting. But like I said, that one I think has a really high bar to clear, and most of the police unions have already come out against it. And the bill was pulled last week from, it was supposed to be heard in committee, and he said he wanted more time to deal with some of their concerns. But he also got pretty heated, the author of the bill, who is a Black man, and pushed back against a lot of these unions' suggestion that elevating the requirements would mean that fewer minority candidates would be hired. And he just straight up called those contentions racist.
How long has this been a call for reform from advocates, the age and degree specifically? I know that there's been sort of discussions about changing hiring practices, but I've always heard them to be sort of pushing for more local hires, but hiring people from the community, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think it's relatively new. It is something that I heard Shirley Weber mentioned in the last couple of years as something that was increasingly on her radar were hiring practices and education. Because, you know, every time there's like a high profile shooting, we talk about things at the very back end, like how can we train the person to use their weapon better? And we're talking about people who are already officers, who are already out carrying a gun, and the very, very moments right before you may or may not shoot someone. And so this is, you know, attacking the problem from the other side of the spectrum, which is who are we bringing in to become officers in the first place? And so, like I said, the author of the bill seems to have a few different pieces of research that have showed that that is one of the sort of defining factors is whether you are educated. So I think that's the reasoning behind it.
The mayor, though, like as he proposed, he could do his own standards, right? They don't need a state law.
Yeah, of course.
Well, I think there's two interesting things going on here then. If he's cutting overtime, which is in effect the paychecks of a lot of these officers, and if they're going to pursue like higher standards of recruitment, that could compound into a more difficult hiring environment, which they've been trying to combat for the last 15 years since I've been here to make sure they can recruit new officers to San Diego Police Department.
They have, although in that time, it has been stated very clearly by previous police chiefs that the problem was not pay at all, but the fact that the media specifically and the community often was so anti-police that no one wanted to do the job at any payment. So you could maybe make the case that if that's true, then increasing the qualifications required to become a police maybe makes it a more prestigious, more fairly looked upon position, and you won't have to deal with the mean people at the media making it a job that no one wants to do.
Yeah, the author of the bill has made that case. He said he wants to really elevate the perception of the profession in the community and have, you know, this level of trust built back in that these are professional people you're out there dealing with and that you can have a certain measure of trust in them. And he thinks that elevating the standards is one way to do that.
Yeah, it seems like if you combine it with all the other points about the demilitarization and such, it really does feel like they're trying to move it from a military that you enlist in to a wholly different system, frankly. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
Speaking of the San Diego City budget, next week on Wednesday the 21st, Voice of San Diego is hosting an event dedicated to the budget. Our reporter, Lisa Halverstadt, is going to lead a panel of guests to discuss infrastructure, homelessness, and other major items the city will be dealing with. The panel includes council members Chris Kate and Sean Elo Rivera, and Kira Green from the Center on Policy Initiatives, and Mike Zaquet of the Municipal Employees Association. It'll be a great time and a good opportunity to learn and ask questions about the city budget. Again, that's Wednesday, April 21st. Get more info at vosd.org/events. Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
Okay, one of the things that caught my eye in the budget announcement that the mayor just made about his proposed budget for the city of San Diego, is that the convention center got, at least through him, its request for $10 million to help it kind of get its financial footing after what has happened to conventions, which were ended by the coronavirus and the resulting restrictions and such. So that, of course, comes after a crazy year for the convention center. So again, let's go back. They shut down everything, Comic-Con, everything shut down. And there was a pretty good sense at the convention center that it was, everything was lost. The 486 employees or whatever were going to be toast. And when would it ever come back? There was this huge debt developing. It has all this, you know, infrastructure that needs to get taken care of. The plan to expand it, the tax increase to expand it, had just supposedly failed. But it reinvented itself as a shelter. So obviously we moved hundreds, more than 1,000 homeless San Diegans into it to shelter there while getting a little bit more space and protecting them from the coronavirus in place of maybe other alternatives to put them in hotels or what. And Lisa Halberstadt, I thought, did a pretty good job tracking in two different stories how the convention center, because of this, and now the migrants who are staying there, the young girls who are seeking asylum or otherwise being processed after arriving in this country, that has protected it, the convention center financially, at least in some respects. So there are 226 staff members there. That's down from that 486 in late March 2020, but it's not zero. And a lot of those are being funded by, not at first, the city that was paying them to take care of all these homeless residents, but now is the federal government is paying a premium to have the convention center take care of all these migrant children. Lisa went back and actually sort of isolated this one situation with the federal government, Sarah, where she pointed out that they gave the city a discount on how much they were going to charge to run it as a shelter for homeless residents. They did not do that for the federal government. And they actually hope to recover a lot of their reserves by charging the federal government even more than their costs to pull this off. Is that how it goes?
Yeah, I was sort of surprised at how candidly the convention center CFO kind of framed it and just said straight up, we're hoping to more than recoup our costs. And for the purpose specifically of building up the reserves, which is just, you know, it's a corporation, so it's understandable, but it's just also kind of wild in the context of you're talking about money you're getting from the federal government to house children.
The way I guess I was thinking about it is like San Diego, the city of San Diego is sort of like a landlord to them of sorts, right? So operating in a cost neutral or even losing money from the organization that butters your bread, basically, is one thing. But they treated the federal government more like they would have treated a convention. You know, there's no rule against them operating at a profit when they bring Comic-Con in. So that's what they sought to do with the federal government. And I guess it's different than the city of San Diego in that the federal government doesn't have the same sort of financial crisis that cities and states had during the crisis because they can print money.
But they're also going to make the city pay them $10 million more this year to recover.
There's
so they might
that.
As well have charged more too.
Yeah.
I think, I think this is interesting in the context of a lot of these discussions going on. So I just noticed too that the mayor proposed cutting $6.9 million from library operation hours. So in effect, we're giving a subsidy to the convention center, but cutting hours, 2 days of hours from the libraries that are still not open, by the way. So that's just really interesting display of priorities, I think. But going back, I mean, the convention center survived financially by becoming a shelter for the most vulnerable people around us right now. And that's just a really interesting tale of reuse of that facility. It goes from hosting conventions and Comic-Con and proctologists and such to saving people. It's a fascinating transformation.
I feel like that's not the first time.
Those proctologists are saving people, sir.
I feel like every time you mention the big events at the convention center, you mention Comic-Con and proctologists. Like, it's like your go-to line.
I don't even know if the proctologists.
I know,
have
but that's what that's.
Do they?
I don't know. It's funny because of butts. long-term listeners of this show know that I'm not the world's greatest convention center apologist, but it is refreshing to know that this very large, very expensive asset that figures into so many of our conversations about what to do as a city is at least useful as an asset outside of hosting proctologists.
That's true. That's true. It did come in handy, and they did mobilize it to be useful during a time when it was literally not useful.
Right.
Yeah, I think if you would ask somebody to describe the convention center, things like flexible and adaptable probably wouldn't come to mind, no. But it ended up being that.
I think, and there's another thing. A lot of people brought up this sort of per person, per month cost that it was costing the city to house people. at the convention center. And it makes a lot more sense when you realize that, well, it was paying for all these cooks and other workers at the convention center that were going to be laid off. And now they're going to be prepared to host conventions again.
Which is ostensibly going to happen in like August?
Well, that was the other part of Lisa's story. Yeah. So she checked in with the next conventions. I think there's a medical one and a psychologist one in August. And neither of them were willing to say that they were going to come, right? Like one of them was a little bit more positive, it seemed like. Comic-Con itself had been saying it was going to come back in November, and they changed their mind, right? They're not doing anything. So,
oh, that Thanksgiving Comic-Con thing is not happening anymore?
Yeah.
No.
It's donezo.
Yeah, I know. And I think, I mean, it'll be kind of weird when there's another big, like, few thousand people at the convention center, right? I mean, regardless of the safety, the actual safety and stuff, it's just this whole world needs to start to, like, inch its way back to those sorts of things. And I don't know which. It seems like doctors doing it first would be pretty confidence building, maybe. But if they don't do it, that's also the opposite. Also,
well, there's a lot of concerts selling tickets to events in the fall right now. So at least that group of that people, that industry seems to think that large gatherings are going to take place in September, October.
Mm-hmm. And we're trying to plan PolitiFest. We're not sure what we're going to be allowed to do or what we're going to be comfortable doing or what our great fans are being comfortable doing as well. So October or so, I guess we'll find out.
In the meantime, is the July 15th deadline for people, for migrant children moving out of the convention center? What if we still need a place for them to be? What if the surge such as it is still continuing? Are we duty bound to end this experiment on July 15th, regardless of circumstances?
I think that the whole point was that the federal government's going to do that somewhere, right?
Right.
This was just, this facility was built or was contracted to do it. I would assume that others would pick up the slack, or I don't know, they would find other alternatives. Or we could bid again. Let's go.
Yeah, it just seems like if there aren't going to be, like right now, we at least have the possibility that conventions are going to resume. But if that's not going to happen, and the federal government is just going to need to find another place to stand up an operation, much like the one that will have already been operating for 4 months by that point, it seems like it would be easier to just continue doing it here.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast in San Diego that is recorded in my garage where I fell off my Indo board while talking on the phone again, and I shouldn't do that. It is the most popular public affairs podcast that is recorded in that way. Keep up with all of our news, analysis, and investigations with the Morning Report. Check it out at vosd.org/morning. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice of San Diego. Andrew Keats is Assistant Editor. Sarah Libby's Managing Editor. And the show was produced expertly by Nate John. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.